Thank you. Good morning. Yesterday we already heard some very nice examples of experimental work, especially stretching the limits of graphene with suspended graphene, with graphene on boron nitride. So the question obviously is, what happens with, for instance, charge transport, but also spin transport, when we really start to explore the ultimate limit of graphene? And I will give you two examples of that, one with charge transport and one with spin transport, where we made an attempt to see what really happens if we increase the mobility of the material. So let me immediately start, if this thing works here. Let me start, and I go back a long time, almost a quarter of a century, 1988. Some people, including myself, were working on a two-dimensional electron gas. What it is, it's basically a very standard one. It is gallium arsenide. It's not so clear here, but it's aluminum gallium arsenide on top. So below the surface buried, there is a two-dimensional electron gas. And what was very special about that is that the mobility was very high. It was a million. And it's nowadays it can be 10 million, but a million is very high. But what was more important is that the mean free path for electrons was about 10 micrometers. So the average length on which the electron scatters back was 10 micrometers. So that was very interesting for us, because now we could make devices which were actually smaller than that. So what we used is a technique which was called split gate technique. We put on top a pattern like this, which is a gate, where we apply a negative voltage, so we could make a constriction, so we can actually measure between these two contacts. Electrons can only go through the constriction from here to here. But remember, the mean free path is about this, so it's much longer. So we could explore ballistic transport. And as a surprise, we were not prepared for this, we got a big surprise, a big present from nature. What we observed, if you change the conductance as a function of the gate voltage, you see that you get a very nice staircase of steps, and each step is 2e squared over h. And we, of course, when we saw this, we immediately connected this with the Landauer description, which basically tells you, well, that you can associate a conductance with each channel of 2e squared over h. So the total conductance is the sum of all channels times this 2e squared over h times the transmission of the channel. And here you can clearly switch on the transmission from 0 to 1. And I have a picture here. So this is the illustration, which I'll come back to that later. So this is the energy. This is the momentum along the channel. This is the lowest subband, as it's called. So in this situation, you apply a voltage. So these are carriers which move to the right, which are occupied up to a certain energy mu 1. This is carriers go to the left. So immediately you have to know that you can calculate the current by summing up the contributions of the electrons in this energy range. And of course, a special feature of 1D transport is that no matter how the dispersion looks like, when you have one subband occupied and you have a clean system, your transmission is 1, then your conductance is 2e squared over h. So we were, of course, also interested in figuring out how does this transpose to graphene. And then we are immediately into trouble, because these are calculations of the energy dispersion of nanoribbons. But immediately you see that the dispersion looks already much more complicated than what I've shown. In gallium arsenide, we have massive carriers. It's parabolic, very simple. Here it's more complicated. I'm not going into all the details, but you can already see that there's a difference between zigzag and armchair edges. For instance, what you see here, if you would tune your Fermi energy, you go start at the neutrality point, you lift it up, you find you have here states going to the right, states going to the left. There is one mode, each mode contains two spins, so you would get a conductance of 2e squared over h. If you go higher, then you hit these two, and here you can still recognize the separate valleys. So that means you have now, you go to 6, you go to 10, etc. So this is the quantization sequence you would expect there. But if you have armchair, it gets very different, because this is the case where this armchair ribbon has actually a gap, so the conductance is 0. Then you cross this one, it's now 2e squared over h, 4e squared over h, 6e squared over h. If you make this armchair just one, if you add just one row to it, you can get this situation where now there is the gap vanishes, and you will have you will already start at 2e squared over h. So what is the bottom line of this? So if I want to study conductance quantization in graphene, I better make a very well-defined nano ribbon where I can control the edges. And I don't know how to do that at the moment, but I will show you that the experiment shows that this is not really necessary. So there is technology involved. I will be very short on this. We developed an alternative to the suspended graphene technology, which is only based on polymers. So we start, of course, again with silicon oxide, but we avoid basically the etching of the silicon oxide with HF. And this is nice if you use gold as context, but if you use other materials, the HF will eat away the material. So, for instance, if you want to combine this with ferromagnetic context, we need another technology. This is what we developed. It works very well. If you want to know more about it, please have a look at this reference. So this is what we get. This is a suspended graphene sample, and I'm showing this to you for two purposes. This is, you can see this is suspended because this is slightly above the substrate. You see there's a lot of junk on it, so this is basically polymer remains. This is, we have to get rid of that, and the way we do it is, as other people do, we use current annealing, we send a big current through. Then you see, apparently the junk is not fully removed, but you can really see that there are different regions appearing. So this still looks the same as this, so apparently this has not been heated up too much. Here it has really become very hot. But you see two things. One of them, of course, that the structure of what is on top has changed, but also that it has a tendency to form a constriction. And that is very important for what I will be talking about. So this is another example. So this is a non-annealed suspended graphene. This is, has been annealed. And this, well, apparently has been annealed more. You see, apparently the process sets in, which we do not fully understand, but where somewhere from the edge it starts to make a constriction. This is all black magic, because we cannot fully control it. So sometimes, of course, these samples just break during the annealing process. So we have to be lucky. Does it work? The answer is yes, it works. What you see is clearly the resistance as a function of the gate voltage. Again, I'm not going into details here. You can check the mobility. It really gets very, very high. And André Geim already showed that in their case you can reach a million or something. What is important is that in this case, the mean free path of the electrons is in between 250 and 500 nanometers. So keep that in mind. So what we are going to do? Well, we said this is very nice, clean material. Of course, we also want to see how the quantum Hall effect behaves. This is a two-terminal device. Again, if you think about the quantum Hall effect as transport via edge channels, we have to be a bit careful there. You can really understand the two-terminal conductance, because you simply have to count the number of edge channels which start from one contact and go to the other. And that is basically determined by the number of lambda levels. This is a very well-known picture. Let me just point it out. So let's look at this trace, which is at a few Tesla. 2e squared over h, 6e squared over h, and 10e squared over h, we have single-layer graphene. But what is very interesting is if you reduce the magnetic field, so we go, let's say, to 0.1 Tesla. It's not so clear here anymore, but let's zoom in what happens. You see that even at 0.1 Tesla, which is pretty low, there is still a very, very nicely defined quantum Hall plateau. So the quality, again, this represents the quality of the material. You also see that the Dirac neutrality point is very close to zero. Again, some evidence that apparently this sample which we are studying is very clean. You see there is some asymmetry between electrons and holes, so it's not yet perfect, but it's pretty good. So now you can already guess what is going to happen. I'm going to show you the trace at zero Tesla. Zero Tesla. Hey, what is this now? So your conductance steps have not disappeared, whereas we are now at zero Tesla. So what's going on? Well, to do that, we now replot this data, and we don't plot it as a function of the gate voltage anymore, but we plot the conductance now as a function of the Fermi wave number. Why do we do that? Because we can make a very simple approximation. This is a classic, semi-classical approximation that we can, for the conductance, we can say, well, if this is now determined by not by the lambda level quantization, but by a size quantization in a sort of constriction, we can write this conductance as 4e squared over h, and now the 4 is we have two valleys and we have two spins, times kfw over pi. Well, again, this is basically counting the number of wavelengths which fit in the constriction. So it's a semi-classical approximation. So, but first of all, let's look at the data. The conductance as a function of kf would, according to this formula, on average have to show a continuous increase. Well, we are ignoring quantization here, but what we see now, we see more or less linear increase, but of course we see the formation of a very nice plateau at 2 squared over h, features there, and on the this is on the hole side, and on the electron side we get similar behavior. We can now fit it, so we say, well, what has happened now? Because we started with a graphene strip, which is a micrometer wide or something, or 2 micrometer wide. So this is clearly not 2 micrometer. So our conjecture is that during this annealing process, there has this constriction formation has started, and then you can immediately imagine that this annealing current is concentrated in this relatively small area. So that's heated quite a lot. So we also guess, we estimate that there also the annealing process has been very, very efficient. So how can we make an estimate of the width? Well, we use this formula, and then we basically make a fit. Then we get something like 275 nanometers on this side, and on the electron side it's 200 nanometers. It's not that we claim now that the width depends on whether you look at the hole side or the electron side, but it just because we see there is a smaller symmetry, so the actual width will be somewhere in between. This is very surprising, I have to say, because look at the edges. Well, what we made is something like this. So clearly you will have some messy edge, alternation of zigzag and armchair, etc. So if you would make a very long strip ribbon and you would go from armchair to zigzag, or you would go from change the different widths, here you would have a gap, here you would not have a gap, it would become a mess. So what we guess, what is happening here is that this constriction is not only narrow, it's also short. Yeah, so short enough that the electrons effectively feel some average, I'm not sure if the word average is appropriate, some average boundary condition which is put on by the edges. Well, what do we expect there, since we will have some armchair and some zigzag behavior? Well, the armchair clearly lifts the degeneracy. This introduces intervalley scattering. So then it clearly explains why we now see the steps are in units of 2e squared over h, right? So clearly we have some armchairs, we'll mix the valley, so we'll be lifting the valley, so that is consistent. But let me show you a bit more. So how can we now, we are in the dark of this, with this sample, we don't know what it is, we know it is a constriction, and we think it's about this wide, how can we check it? Well, then of course we can immediately go back to our results, because we see that this quantum Hall effect quantization does not suddenly go over in size quantization. There is a very nice continuous evolution. And we know, of course, from the experiments on gallium arsenide, how to understand that. Because we know that in p equal to zero, we have, of course, well, this is a typical motion of the electrons, and there is a confinement in this direction. If you switch on your magnetic field, you will introduce, of course, a cycloton orbit, well, it will still hit this boundary, and then finally, if you reach a critical value, this picture is not fully correct. So if twice the cycloton radius exactly fits into the width, then basically these electrons can actually propagate along this edge, these electrons propagate along this edge, and we don't see the effect of the width anymore. So then we are fully back in the quantum Hall regime. So well, we can plot. How do we do that? We basically plot the positions of these plateaus as a function, measured as a in gate voltage as a function of magnetic field. If these would be pure lambda levels, then we simply would have a linear dependence going back, extrapolating to zero. Here we see if we do that. Well, now my thing is giving up. Is there another pointer? Here is probably another. If we do that, then we see that we at from about this value, 50 millitesla, the position saturates, and we have a finite gate voltage or a finite density, which is exactly what you expect. And this transition should occur when the cyclotron radius, twice the cyclotron radius, would fit in our constriction. Well, we can put in the numbers because we know the magnetic field, we know the cyclotron radius, and we get something like 300 nanometers. So again, this confirms the fact that we are dealing with a constriction which provides us this size quantization. Whatever more can we do, and I have to speed up a little bit. For instance, well, so this is a situation where you observe these quantized conductors. Why? Because I'm only dealing with states in between mu1 and mu2 from one subend. Here, clearly, we are in trouble, because here we these states do not contribute. So here we do not expect quantization anymore. Here we are also in trouble, because now the bias voltage is so big that we start to occupy already states in the second subend. So again, deviation from quantization. And why am I telling you this? Because if we now measure the bias dependence of our conductance, we can basically also determine what is the subend spacing. So this looks like a bit wild plot. So what we have done, we have measured the differential conductance, I should say, as a function of the source drain bias for various gate voltages. And what does this now mean? Here we have a concentration of lines are close together. So this would correspond to a plateau. Here is a plateau and here is a plateau. This is done at 0.5 Tesla in a quantum Hall regime as more or less a reference. So you see nice plateaus. If you increase the bias voltage, for instance, here, the quantization is almost fully gone. So we can check that indeed this corresponds with a Landau level spacing. So that's our reference. But we can do now also the same at zero magnetic field. It doesn't look so nice, but you can still recognize this is a plateau. There's another one, there's another one. And there's more structures going on, which we do not fully understand. But you would say at about 5 millivolt, your quantization is gone. Again, we can put in the numbers, and we get for a width typically a value of 230 nanometers. So this is all consistent. So, unfortunately, of course, what we wanted to do is take the device out, check it in a microscope. Why did this? But, well, you could already have guessed what's happened. These are very brittle structures, so if there is any thermal expansion, they break. So we could not check the width of this sample. But again, we have three independent determinations of the width. So I think there cannot be any escape from this conclusion that we have observed conductance quantization. This would be nice, but it gets even nicer. And I'm going to show you this because there's a lot of theorists in the audience and single particle pictures are usually not so interesting for theorists. Well, I will show you a little bit more. So this I've explained. So we have the formation of the first plateau sits at 2 squared over h. Why? Because we have one mode and we have two spin directions. The magnetic fields which we apply are still relatively small. So there is, of course, some Zeeman splitting, but it's still much, much smaller than the temperature. I think the temperature is something like a Kelvin or so. Nevertheless, we see already quite soon that there is some structure appearing. This one, it's pretty clear. Here it vanishes again, but it's pretty clear that it's there and on both sides. It's not an artifact. At 0.6 times 2 e squared over h. And now some of you might remember the 0.7 structure in quantum point contacts. We believe that this is very similar to what is happening in quantum point contacts in semiconductors. So this is of course a very intriguing one because it is the true signature of electron-electron interaction. So let me summarize this part of the talk. So I've shown you that in one sample, only one sample, we have observed conductance quantization. We believe that this is possible because it's not only narrow, but also short. Yeah, so that we don't have to, you cannot truly describe one part of the constriction as having, let's say, a certain width and the other one another width. We have to take into account some average effective boundary condition, which lifts the valley degeneracy and also forms some kind of gap at zero density. We see that we have a continuous evolution into a quantum Hall regime. 2 e squared over h plateau is surprisingly accurate and flat. So you could really show it's very accurate. It's not so easy to understand how this can be. We have observed 0.6 structure, which I would call it. This is a very interesting one. So we have high quality material we go to low densities, and as you have seen, several of the properties, in particular the energy spacing, depends on the Fermi velocity. So wouldn't it also be possible to say something about any Fermi velocity renormalization? And we have looked into that and still have no definite conclusion, but we have to be extremely careful, because if we would certainly know the width, then we could really compare the numbers, but we have to extract the width from our measurements. So we cannot fully draw any conclusions there. What we can conclude is that we need more devices, and we are working on that. This is the second part of the talk. So this is about spins, and this is about boron nitride. So I will not give you a full overview about spin relaxation in graphene. That would be almost an entire conference by itself. We will hear more about it in the next talks. What, of course, you have heard is that the intrinsic spin orbit interaction in graphene is very weak. Nevertheless, what we observe is spin orbit interaction. We observe spin relaxation. What's going on? So to make for my talk, it's only necessary that you remember two mechanisms. One of them is, you could say, the scattering-induced spin orbit interaction, and the scattering can be from impurities, from ripples, whatever. So that when the momentum of the particle is changed, there is also a small change in the spin. This is called Elliott-Yaffet mechanism. The other one is the Raspa type of interaction, spin orbit interaction, which is very important in two-dimensional semiconductor systems. There the idea is, I create an electric field like this. The electron moves in this electric field, so also sees part of this electric field as an effective magnetic field. This is a simple description, but now the point is, it is always seeing an effective magnetic field, and if it changes direction, the effective magnetic field changes. So what is happening is that the electron spin is processing around the magnetic field, then the magnetic field changes a bit, the electron starts to process around that other magnetic field. And then you can actually show that of course, if you have a lot of scattering, it wants to process in one direction, then the effective magnetic field changes, it processes in another direction. So if the effective magnetic field changes faster, then also the spin relaxation will become slower. So that means that if I have more scattering, more changing of my momentum, then actually the spin relaxation time will increase. So it's the opposite behavior of Elliott effect. So what do we want to do? We want to prepare samples with different mobilities. Yeah? So we can compare spin relaxation in one sample compared to the other one. And then we can at least distinguish between these two different processes. There is much more to be said. I had a very recent paper by Paco, which actually shows that the Elliott-Yaffet mechanism in graphene is slightly different, or is different from in metals. I will not go into that. I will just show you one example how we try to make the distinction between these two mechanisms. So this is the spin injection scheme. So we have a ferromagnet, cobalt in our case, spin polarized states. We are interested in the density of states at the Fermi energy, which is different. So then the idea is, if we pass a current from a ferromagnet in this case it's not graphene, but it doesn't matter, into a non-magnetic material, we can induce spin accumulation, because in this case we inject more spin down electrons, so we increase the electrochemical potential of the spin down electrons. How much have I got?
10 minutes.
Okay. The other mechanism works also. So if we have spin accumulation and we couple it to a ferromagnet, so here we have an excess of spin down electrons. They can more easily go into that ferromagnet. So then this ferromagnet will develop a voltage, and if I now change the magnetization of my ferromagnet, then of course the spin up and the spin down are interchanged, then this voltage will go from positive, it will go to negative. So we can inject spins with spin direction determined by the magnetization of the ferromagnet. If we have spin accumulation, we can detect it by measuring a voltage difference between the ferromagnet being magnetized in this direction compared to the other one. So this is a well-known trick. This is the Bloch equation we use, not going into many details here, because of time. This is basically mu is the spin accumulation. It's a three-dimensional thing. It has three components, x, y, and z. This is the diffusion term, diffusion constant. This is a relaxation term. and this is a precession term. What is important is that for the spin relaxation length, which is a very important quantity, it can be determined by the square root of the diffusion constant times the relaxation time, because it's a diffusive process. So if I increase my relaxation time by a factor of 4, then my spin relaxation length will increase by a factor of 2. This is the typical device. So we have silicon, silicon oxide graphene. And what we do is we make a circuit, current circuits here. So the idea is we inject spins here, which go into the graphene. And although the current flows only in this circuit, the spins, of course, can still diffuse in this direction. So they can reach this contact. And depending on whether the spin direction survives, voltage will develop. And we can measure this. We can measure this voltage if we change the difference in the magnetization. Again, I'm not going to go into detail. This is just what we measured some time ago. What you see if you change your magnetic field, you apply a magnetic field in the plane, your magnetization directions change. You see a lot of switches. They correspond to switches in the injector or the detector. This is evidence that indeed spins can survive from injector to detector. We obtain there something like a spin relaxation length of 1.5 micrometer. Keep that in mind. There's another way to look at, analyze this, and it's called Handler precession. So now we inject spins in the plane, let's say upwards, then we put the magnetic field perpendicular, the spins start to precess around that field. And of course, the amount of precession determines on the magnetic field, but also on the transport process. So of course it's diffusing, the transport process is diffusive, so spins do not go directly from there to there. Some are very fast, some are a bit slower. So what you finally get is a Handler signal which can have different shapes. I'm not going into detail, but you can extract again the spin relaxation time and the diffusion constant from it. So it's a very, very elegant technique. This is a typical shape of such a Handler curve. These are the parameters we got. Keep that in mind, about 150 picoseconds for the spin relaxation time. For the spin relaxation length, something like 2 micrometer, 1.5, 2 micrometer. These are measurements of room temperature. So this is the reference. Let me skip this part. Now about boron nitride. So what we have to do, and this makes the process a little bit different, more difficult if you have normal contacts, because as André Geim already showed, there are a lot of annealing steps, and we cannot do all these annealing steps with ferromagnetic contacts, because basically the contacts will become ineffective. So nevertheless, we succeeded in doing that. We have a slightly different technique. If you want to look into that, please have a look. But now we made a device, which is very nice, because you have silicon oxide. There is this boron nitride flake, and now we have deposited graphene, a very long graphene strip, which sits here on the silicon oxide, but then here it sits on the boron nitride. And we make contacts, ferromagnetic contacts, to both of them. So we can directly compare the spin behavior in graphene on silicon oxide or graphene on boron nitride. So what we can see, where is it going? So first of all, there is a difference in mobility. So for the graphene part on silicon oxide, it's about 5,000, and there it's 15,000. It's not a huge difference, because again, we cannot do all the annealing steps, but it's a significant difference. So what we now see is that the spin relaxation time in the graphene on the silicon oxide is of this order, and on the boron nitride, it increases by a factor of 2, 2.5 or something. The diffusion constant, of course, obviously also increases, because the mobility is larger. So that also means that our spin relaxation length, which was about 1.5 micrometer for graphene on silicon oxide, now becomes about 6 micrometer at room temperature. So this is something about the mechanism. Clearly, if we increase the mobility, the spin relaxation time goes up. So it points a bit that in single layer, we have Elliott effect. Where does it all go to? Suppose now we would be able to go to 100,000. I'll leave this extrapolation up to you. So we go from 5,000 to 50,000, we go from 1.5 to 6. Now we would go, let's say, to 100,000. If we can make a device, where does the spin relaxation length go to? Does it go to 100 micrometer? I don't know, we'll have to see. Okay, this is my group. I would like to thank my group for their contributions, and I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I have time for some questions. So for the boron nitride experiment, did you have local tunnel barriers or did you cover the whole flake with aluminum oxide?
No. That's a very good question. So I did not mention that we do between the cobalt contacts and the graphene, we put a thin layer of oxide. Why? Because if you make direct contact, basically these ferromagnets, they eat up the spins. So you will reduce your signal. What we have done there, to answer your question directly, we only have this oxide layer underneath the contacts. That is because we want nothing on the graphene. Certainly we don't want to have anything on the graphene which could affect our mobility.
So on your QPC data on the 0.6 structure, that's very close to 0.5, right? You could just be seeing conductance at 1 E square over H, which at fields of 1 Tesla, as you're showing in suspended graphene, is quite common to have all symmetries broken.
Maybe then I would like to understand a bit more, but well, at least my understanding was, but maybe it's not complete, that the only way the spin degeneracy cannot be lifted because due to the Zeeman interaction, because that is too small. But what you're saying is that it could be another mechanism to lift the valley degeneracy.
Yeah, I mean, this is seen in many graphene devices already at this field that also
makes a problem. Well, okay, but here it disappears. What develops is there's more structure developing at higher fields, but we only at 2 Tesla. But basically, this structure about here disappears. So what I think is going on is that apparently you see that this conductance is only drops here. It starts to drop more, and then immediately you start to see the formation of this. Of this structure, so it could well be that it in principle could also be there at zero fields. The only reason that you don't see it is that the conductance doesn't go down. But I mean, I would be interested to discuss with you. Yeah.
You have another plateau at 4 E squared over H, which at zero field, which should disappear in finite field. Can you tell which is the energy difference between that plateau and the one at 6, for instance?
Let me see. Now I have to be careful. So we have the sequence 2, 4, 6, and of course in high magnetic field we only have 2 and 6. So the 4 should disappear. Yeah, that's what you. That what is your question? What is the energy? I have to be careful now. What I'm saying. I have to go back. I think we also have a plot for the second one. It's not in this one, but I think in our paper it is. But it basically disappears at very similar, a slightly different field. But again, it corresponds again with this argument comparing the cyclotron radius with the width.
The devices with boron nitride, could the presence of the device also on silicon oxide lead to additional spin scattering, which you sort of like see as reduced spin relaxation time on the boron nitride? So as a sink?
The answer is no, because this device is really, this graphene flake is very long. So it's longer than the spin relaxation length. So you basically say, suppose now the spin relaxation length would be even higher on the boron nitride, but it's still low on the silicon oxide. No, I think that is not. We really have two separate regions, although they're electrically coupled. They are so far apart that there is no effect.
The diffusion coefficient you determined from spin transport, is it the same as from charge transport, or there is a difference?
Okay, in this case it is. So again, we can obtain the diffusion by using from the charge transport from the Einstein relation. Sigma is density of states times E squared times D, or from the Hanle measurement. As a matter of fact, we are actually doing this right now, so I have to be a bit careful. For this case, they are very similar. On silicon carbide, we found that they are different, and we don't understand it. But in this case, they're very similar.
On boron nitride, they're similar.
On boron nitride, they're very similar.
So, Bart, I also have a question about the 0.6 feature that you have. So there are two other things. One is a possible temperature dependence, and the other one is zero bias anomaly. So from your DIDV data, it doesn't seem as there's there a zero bias anomaly, right?
What do you mean exactly with a zero bias
anomaly? So if you go one transfer
let me see here
on the left.
So no, we did not focus for these measurements. We did not focus on the conductance values below one. Of course, that was on our program, but the sample died. But there was another question.
Well, you could also tell something about the temperature dependence.
Yeah, so again, we have only very limited temperature data because, again, these energy scales are relatively high. So we even at 4 Kelvin, I think these effects were still there. But obviously, this will also change here, that's correct. But again, we have not looked into that in detail.
Okay, so I think we should continue, and maybe we can continue the discussion afterwards in the break. So let's first thank Bart again for this very nice talk. So, and we have our second speaker.